Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out. I know it's early and it's the last day, so I'm especially excited to see you. As was mentioned, my name is Pamela Mejia. I am the recently appointed research director for the Berkeley Media Studies Group, and I'm here to talk to you about some of our findings on three different soda tax debates. As we've established, none. And before I do anything else, I want to make sure to acknowledge some of the people and entities that made this work possible, including the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and Healthy Eating Research, and also, very importantly, my colleagues at the Berkeley Media Studies Group, where, like many of us in public health, we are extremely concerned with the policies that shape and sustain healthy environments. And we view the news as an important tool that helps shape how the public and policymakers understand those policies and the public health problems that necessitate them. So that, I think, gives a little bit of grounding for the work that we do researching news coverage of public health and social justice issues so that we can better understand the stories that the news is telling and perhaps more importantly, not telling. We also provide media advocacy training and strategic consultation for community groups and public health advocates to help them more effectively use the news to advance the policy changes that they want to see. And finally, we provide professional education for journalists so that they can ask the questions that will help tell the stories that illustrate the need for those policy changes. For the last year or so, our work at BMSG has been very much occupied, among other things, with soda taxes, and specifically with soda taxes that were proposed in three very different communities. In this audience, I may not need to say much about these communities, but I just want to give a little background so we're all on the same page. In 2012, municipal soda taxes were proposed in two California cities of Richmond and El Monte. These are cities, working-class towns of about 100,000 people located in Northern and Southern California, respectively. Both communities have very large populations of African-American and Latino residents. And in both communities, the proposals were designated, raised by the taxes would ultimately go, there was some maneuvering, but would ultimately go towards the maintenance and development of public health and physical education programs in the community, sports fields, after-school programs, et cetera. Fortunately, in both communities, voters overwhelmingly voted down these proposals in November of 2012. But advocates weren't defeated, and in 2013, a similar tax was proposed in the mountain town of Telluride, Colorado. Telluride is very different. It's a small, predominantly white town of about 2,000 people located in the mountains of Colorado and a well-known ski destination. I was very excited to find the ski man. There, the funds raised by the tax would go to the support of a local physical education program whose funding was set to expire. But there, too, the tax was defeated in November of 2013, about a year ago. These three towns and the policies proposed within them obviously had some differences, but a key similarity that united them was the extent to which the beverage industry did not want to see the taxes pass. In all three communities, the beverage industry spent heavily on anti-tax campaigns. In Richmond, a town of, as I said, about 100,000 people, they spent over $2 million to defeat the campaign. In El Monte, about 100,000 people again, over $1 million. And in Telluride, a town of 2,000 people, estimates are that they spent about $100,000 to defeat the campaign. So obviously, these were very controversial, newsworthy debates. They generated national and local coverage, and we wanted to explore that coverage to understand who spoke and what they said and what some of the patterns and implications were for other soda tax advocates. I'm a big methods nerd, so I could talk all morning about what we did, but in the interest of brevity, I urge you to visit our website or ask me for a copy of one of the two products that we produced. I will say that we developed a scientifically selected sample of national and local coverage from each of the three campaigns, and we explored it for messengers, messages, themes. Let's highlight a couple of those findings here. So the first and maybe one of the most basic questions is just, well, how much coverage was there? When did it show up? This is a bit of a complex chart, but I think a couple of takeaways are, first of all, that Richmond was definitely a driver, having generating significantly more coverage than either of the other two campaigns. Another important point worth noting is that the majority, though not all, of the coverage around each of the campaigns tended to happen right around the election. Not always, but generally speaking, the majority of the coverage we saw was around October, November, which has yielded some important implications for thinking about creating and generating, disseminating news about SOTA taxes to build support throughout the period leading up to that election. Now, these lines include both news and opinion coverage, so we wanted to pull that apart a little. What did each community look like in terms of straight, unbiased news and opinion coverage, like editorials, letters to the editor, and op-eds? Again, this is a bit of a complex chart, so I'll break it down a bit. The solid green bars represent news coverage, that is, straight or unbiased opinion, straight or unbiased coverage by reporters. The red bars represent opinion coverage, your editorials, op-eds, letters, etc., that took a distinctly anti-tax stand. The blue bars are the opposite, opinion coverage that took a decidedly pro-tax stand. And what we can see is that there were differences across communities in the extent to which advocates used opinion coverage. In Richmond and El Monte, straight news coverage dominated, and in El Monte, so too did anti-tax opinion coverage. Anti-tax opinion coverage was a little more evenly split in Richmond, but in Telluride, residents and advocates, residents especially, were very passionate about engaging with the opinion space in their local papers and blogs. So opinion coverage dominated, and unfortunately most of it was anti-tax in nature. And the majority of those were letters to the editor, by the way. So now let's think. Within these unbiased or, you know, nonpartisan news sources and these opinion coverage and opinion pieces, we saw pro and anti-tax arguments appearing. So we wanted to dig in a little into what those arguments looked like. I could go on all morning, as I said, about the arguments that appeared, but I'm going to highlight just a couple of top-line findings that occurred across all three communities on the pro-tax side. The most common argument that tax advocates used, perhaps not surprisingly, focused on the health benefit or the health infrastructure benefit of the taxes to the communities. As one Richmond resident said, I think it's worth paying a few cents to have more sports fields and recreational activities. A second related pro-tax argument focused less on the benefit of the tax and more on illustrating the need for the tax by highlighting, for instance, obesity and diabetes and other health-related issues affecting the community. As one Telluride tax advocate said, we have an obesity epidemic in our nation, and we now know that sugary drinks are the single biggest contributor. A third pro-tax argument, and perhaps my favorite, for lack of a better term, focused less on the need for or benefit of the tax and focused more on the industry's actions in trying to squash the tax with the power of its deep pocketbooks, and derided the industry for attempting to subvert local decision-making. One example came here from El Monte Mayor Andre Quintero, who was the key architect of that city's tax, who said, billboards, cable television ads, events, mailers, canvassing teams, phone banks, legal maneuvers, constant polling, we are under siege. Saw this again and again. On the other side, we also saw a range of arguments opposing the taxes, and here again, I'm just going to highlight a couple that kind of rose to the top across all communities. Perhaps not surprisingly to us in this room, the key anti-tax argument that emerged focused on the economic impact of the tax. In El Monte, one restaurant owner said, for instance, Measure H will raise prices and drive customers out of town. My customers don't want to pay higher prices, and in this economy, fewer can afford to. A related argument, and kind of contradictory if you think about it, framed the tax as an ineffective solution to obesity and health problems. As one Richmond youth said, raising prices will not stop people from handing over their cash at the register, and it will not stop obesity rates from rising. A third argument, one that is perhaps familiar to many of us who work in public health and policy issues, framed the tax, and indeed any effort to address public health issues through policymaking, as government overreach, big brother in your shopping cart. One example came from a Telluride business owner who said, we live here because we enjoy our personal freedom. Now we're being told we shouldn't even be able to buy groceries or order dinner without the government's help. I think this last quote is particularly illustrative because it highlights an important point that I want to emphasize about anti-tax arguments, which is that though there were commonalities across communities, in each town, arguments were tailored or used that evoked the unique character or tensions within that community. For example, Telluride arguments that evoked the town's proud history as a civil liberties safe zone. In Richmond, a community that has been plagued by historical racial divisiveness, we saw arguments that framed the tax as a racist ploy to marginalize people of color. These explicitly racialized arguments appeared only in that community. Part of the power of these arguments comes from who uses them. And I want to say just a word or two here, I know I'm running short on time, about who spoke across all communities and across all arguments. The most common pro-tax speakers included city officials, public health advocates like Harold Goldstein at the California Center for Public Health Advocacy, community residents, and medical personnel. On the other side, anti-tax speakers included community residents and business representatives, perhaps not surprising given the economic thrust of many of the arguments, as well as local anti-tax coalitions and soda industry representatives. A word about those last two. It may be surprising to see that soda industry representatives fall somewhat low, and in fact, they rarely appeared explicitly in the coverage. But local anti-tax coalitions, like Community Coalition Against Beverage Taxes in Richmond, were very present in the coverage. And they popped up in, those coalitions popped up in every community, encompassing community residents, business representatives, church leaders, and other community luminaries and dignitaries. But a close read shows that all of those community groups were, in fact, industry funded. The industry used them to shield themselves from the fray, distance themselves from the soda tax arguments, and also to give power to their anti-tax arguments, which may have meant more coming from a community resident, a neighbor, a friend, than they would from a suited member of the American Beverage Association. Further muddying the waters of the soda industry's involvement is the fact that some of these community residents and business representatives spoke on behalf of local soda tax coalitions, the industry-funded ones, but their affiliation wasn't noted. For example, in Telluride, a local businessman was the head of the local No on 2A coalition funded by the beverage industry, but routinely he appeared in the news just as a concerned local businessman, his industry affiliation obfuscated. So there's a lot of lessons to be learned. A couple of things I want to say that also have popped out for us that we highlight in our pieces. Focus on cultivating a range of authentic voices, we call them at BMSG, that is, speakers from all elements and levels of the community who can speak powerfully and compellingly as to the importance of the soda tax, but not only for that population, but for the community as a whole. This was especially true in Richmond and El Monte, where the pro-tax arguments were really dominated by city officials. It's also important to know your opposition and what they'll say, and to know about the presence, the probability of industry-funded coalitions, and the fact that they may use arguments that are specifically tailored to the unique concerns and tensions in that community. And finally, it's important to remember the journey and the destination, or put another way, as my boss, Lori Dorfman, who's much better with metaphors than I am, talks about pebbles in the water. Picture you're standing next to a rushing stream. I'm from Washington, so I know a lot about those. You can't pass it. You throw a pebble in the water and it sinks to the bottom without a trace. But if you keep throwing pebbles, eventually they'll build up and form a bridge that you can safely walk across. The parallels with policy are obvious. Sometimes policies like the soda taxes we've talked about today don't succeed, but they lay the groundwork for other policies that ultimately can create a bridge across which communities can walk to better health. We saw it in tobacco control, where countless local policies, many of them unsuccessful, ended up laying the foundation for the large-scale tobacco control change that we have seen and continue to see today. And we're starting to see it happening in soda taxes. Just a few weeks ago, my adopted home of Berkeley, California, passed the country's first municipal soda tax, the No on D campaign. I'm taking credit here. I didn't do anything, but I'm very proud. Across the bay in San Francisco, a comparable tax didn't pass, but it garnered more than 50% of the votes. Shocking precedent, unseen in previous campaigns. There, too, we saw some of the same soda industry tricks we've seen before. In San Francisco, a local coalition popped up, framing the issue as one of affordability, a powerful message in a city struggling with affordability and gentrification issues. But advocates also learned. In Berkeley, for example, they built a strong coalition that drew from every corner of the community, powerful spokespeople who made the case compellingly, not only for the importance of the soda tax for that particular pocket of the community, but for the city as a whole. I think my executive director, Lori Dorfman, said it best when she said, Almonte, City of Richmond, and I'll add Telluride, threw big pebbles in the soda tax water last year. Now Berkeley and San Francisco have pushed boulders in. Soon every city in the nation will be able to walk right across, institute sugary drink taxes, and ensure better health for everyone. I'm so proud to be even a small part of that research and work, and thank you all here for doing that work and the work that you do. It's been a pleasure.